Well, Marcus is a professor in Oregon at, is it Oregon, University of Oregon or Oregon State? He will be with us later this summer. This is a book that we asked our winter community this past winter to read. I think it presents an interesting challenge to all of us to have a new look at Jesus. My goal this morning will be to get you to buy this book and read it. Because I think it's one book worth reading. There's a lot of books out there, but this is one that's worth reading. Okay, we're going to try this again here and see if we can.
Is it working now? We're at a loss.
What?
I said, is it working now? We're at a loss.
Okay. Well, let's just try it now. Do we get anything at all?
Nothing, huh?
Well, that's too bad. This stuff's supposed to work. Yeah, modern technology.
It didn't last session.
Huh?
It didn't last session, did it?
Yeah, I just used it. I just used it next door. It worked fine. But it's not working in here. Isn't that strange? Huh. Well, I guess we're at a loss. I don't know.
We need a technician.
Yeah.
I might go take this.
Yeah.
I'll play with it. Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay, by way of getting us into this book, I think Marcus really wants to stimulate our own discussion about the ideas in the book. So what I intend to do today is really let some of his ideas be a stimulus for our own discussion. And hopefully that will whet your appetite to go and read more carefully what Marcus has to say. A lot of his work comes out of a group of scholars that have called themselves a variety of things, but the Jesus Seminar Group is one of the titles that they use. Kind of a new look at the historical Jesus and trying to figure out what Jesus said, how Jesus thought of himself personally. And these people get together regularly or irregularly to actually talk about that and actually vote on what Jesus said and what Jesus didn't say.
And, a democratic Jesus.
And there are two other large volumes that are just hot off the press. But this is the most readable of the three that are currently in vogue. And so I'd like to just work on this with you a bit this morning. Let's begin by asking the question, from your own understanding and background, what are some of the various ways in which Jesus is thought to have thought of himself and his own personal identity? How did Jesus think of himself, do you think? What are some of the ways that either your views or other views that you've heard expressed over time by Christians and others? How did Jesus see himself, do you think? And don't worry about whether you're right or you're wrong. It doesn't have to be your view, it can be anybody's view. That's right. Yeah.
When you said that, comes to my mind as they were doing it. I can't remember the English comedy group, The Life of Someone or
Other.
Yeah, The Life of Brian. They were trying to do kind of a humorous piece on Jesus or Christianity in the Bible. And they found out they couldn't use Jesus because he wasn't humorous in the way they wanted to do it, because the humorous person, the way they wanted to do it, was someone that didn't see life like it was and had a perspective on
Monty Python.
Yeah, Monty Python.
Somebody see that movie? That's crazy. It is funny.
I don't think Jesus thought a lot about himself, you know, who he was or how important he was or that sort of thing. And he was so focused in on the needs of other people that there really wasn't room in his consciousness for a lot of things. Of course, at some point close to the Passion, he was pretty perplexed about, you know,
what his role should be.
What his role was and was it really this, you know what I mean? Turned to everyday stuff, I don't think there was a lot going on in his head, I couldn't be wrong.
Yeah, okay, well, good.
One of the things that's always puzzled me is that I got the impression at times that Jesus was trying to demonstrate or teach his disciples and saying, these things that I do, you can do them too, and greater.
All right.
And that kind of conflicts with my teaching that he is the Son of God and so much more above what the rest of us could ever aspire.
Okay. Right, and yet we have Jesus saying that, don't we? Yeah.
I was just reading that in the book of Malachi, it's a Bible study this morning, and one passage that leaped out at me is where he's instructing the disciples before he sends them out in the world. It says, I come not to bring peace but a sword. It says to me that he knew he was a controversial thinker. He knew that he was kind of a troublemaker.
Yeah.
He grew to see himself finally as an outsider in a sense of modeling values that people didn't really have and weren't going to, if they had them, weren't going to act on them.
Right.
A role model.
Right. Certainly values that were not popular against in the culture that that he lived in. Okay.
But he wasn't really trying to be counterculture, he just was.
Okay.
You know, I guess he doesn't distinguish it.
Right.
Okay, what is the most, amongst Christianity and the views that most of us grew up with, what and may still hold, what's the most popular view in Christianity about who Jesus was? How would you describe, you know, if somebody didn't know anything about Jesus and came up and said, who was Jesus? What would be the most popular answer?
Son of God.
All right, the whole Son of God, whose purpose was what?
Savior.
Savior. All right.
But he was also a true man.
Okay.
He was
perfect.
A paradox of true man. Right.
Okay. The view that's really popular is the one that was kind of popularized for children. This is what I call a Sunday school view. You see in art. It's very meek, mild, sort of all benevolent figure.
Okay. All right. Well, the first thing that Marcus Borg does in this book is he talks about that particular view, and he says that that is, in fact, the most popular view of Jesus that most Christians have held. John 3:16 is an apt description of what most Christians have believed about Jesus. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, and whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. But that kind of encapsulates the popular image of Jesus, that Jesus died for your sins. Borg says, suggests that this was his purpose in a nutshell. And so he spends a little time talking about the most popular view of Jesus in Christianity. Then he goes on to say, now there's a second image of Jesus which has been popular largely in academic circles. It goes back to Schweitzer and so forth. And that's the image of Jesus as the prophetic image of Jesus, an apocalyptic prophet. And Let me see if I can find a statement. And he calls it the scholarly image of Jesus. Jesus as an eschatological prophet. It is to say that Jesus was an eschatological prophet is to say that he saw himself as the prophet of the end to proclaim the end of the world in his own time and the urgency of repentance before it was too late. That was the core message and mission. So if you've studied the life and teachings of Jesus at a seminary or graduate school level, this would be one of the popular images of Jesus that would be produced or asserted. He says about the popular image of Jesus, I wanted to read you this statement, and I should say that you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that Marcus Borg says, and you don't have to either, but what I'm trying to do here is give you a feeling by the end of the hour of what he has to say, and then you can read the book and make your own judgment. He says about the popular view of Jesus, in short, the image of the historical Jesus as a divine or semi-divine being who saw himself as a divine savior whose purpose was to die for the sins of the world, and his message consisted of proclaiming that, is simply not historically true. Rather, it is the product of a blend produced by the early church, a blending of the church's memory of Jesus with the church's beliefs about the risen Christ. The former was seen through the window provided by the latter. So what he's saying is that in terms of the popular view of Jesus, that was developed, of course, post-Jesus by, and is reflected largely by the theology of John and so forth. Then he goes on to talk about the scholarly view of Jesus. And then thirdly, he proposes a third image. And he said, now I'm going to tell you what I think Jesus was all about. And here is the kind of Jewish influence of this new kind of quest for the historical Jesus that's sort of in vogue these days. And that is, a lot of scholars have been looking at Jesus from his Jewish roots and trying to understand Jesus as a Jewish person. And so he talks about Jesus as a charismatic Jew. And that's the and that's going to be his assertion about how he thinks Jesus saw himself and where he drew his wisdom and strength and so forth. Moreover, we shall see, we can be relatively certain of the kind of person he was. A charismatic, not charismatic in the sense of speaking in tongues, but charismatic in terms of a real leader, one who drew others to him and so forth. A charismatic who was a healer, sage, prophet, and revitalization movement founder. And those are going to be key for Borg. And he's going to talk about that in the rest of the book. He's going to say that basically Jesus was a charismatic Jew who was a healer, a sage, a prophet, and a revitalization movement founder. And those are the categories that he's going to use to describe ultimately who he thinks Jesus was. By incorporating all of this and not preoccupying ourselves with the question of whether Jesus said exactly the particular words attributed to him, we can sketch a fairly full and historical, defensible portrait of Jesus. So that's going to be his basic assertion, which is interesting. From his point of view, Jesus doesn't fit into the popular view anymore. He doesn't fit into the scholarly view as the apocalyptic prophet, but fits into what he calls the charismatic Jew, who was a healer, a sage, a prophet, and a revitalization movement founder. Okay, now he says that Jesus is going to do What he does is going to be done out of two places. One is his whole relation to spirit, and secondly, his whole relationship to his culture, largely as a kind of counterculture figure. But let's talk about the first one. First, the whole world of spirit. The term charismatic, Bork said, has a diversity of meanings, some of which can be misleading. Most basically, it means a person who is in touch with the power of the spirit, and it becomes a channel for the power of the spirit to enter the world of ordinary experience. Okay, what this world spirit is interesting. How would you describe the world of spirit? Or what would it mean to be deeply connected to the world of spirit? Bork asserts that this is kind of a lost art in our society today, that we have largely discounted the world of spirit. And let's put some sort of flesh on that, so it's not one of these things, you know, spirit kind of floats around out there, I think, for us somehow. It's a nebulous kind of thing, but let's see if we can embody spirit. Yeah.
Well, I think one area is in the other sessions, Cheryl Hayes been talking about the switch in the science and technology have gotten separated out from where it's back in earlier times in the early church that theologians really, it was all together. In other words, it has got separated out now. Now there's kind of a movement to get this back together, nature and the spirit. The spirit is, spirit is universal. Right? And so it doesn't, there's not a separate spirit out there governing nature.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a major struggle that exists in our time. We have grown up in a culture which has split spirit and nature. We've done that a lot in our religions, and our religion, certainly in Christianity, has split spirit and nature. So it wasn't those spiritual things were over here somehow, and natural things, the reality that we live with day by day was over here, and the two didn't somehow fit together. Yeah?
Well, this, I guess, goes along with the thing with what he spirit. I think of it as a dissolving of boundaries and borders, and feeling of oneness or interconnectedness, a wholeness. And I guess that's what he's saying. I'm just about that feeling.
All right, good. Let's get as many images out as possible.
Yeah, I see spirit as being a force, being almost an energy form.
A real concrete example of spirit that we all talk about in everyday language is if your local team is going to have a great, the wonderful team that are going to turn into a school spirit, or if you're going to have a community activity, you talk about the spirit of the community.
So there's energy.
It fits the definition.
The question was, how did Jesus see spirit?
Right. That's what we want to get to.
Yeah. I think he was close enough to the sort of agricultural, pastoral sort of setting, the time when they saw spirit in all aspects of nature, the weather, the planting, fertility, birth, disease, casting out demons, other spirits, evil spirits. I mean, I think he saw a whole world of spirit in everything.
A lot of other cultures, so-called more primitive cultures, but really they're as, every bit as sophisticated as our own, specifically like Native American cultures, there is a lot more attention to spirit, and I think they access the spirit world through things like visions and dreams, which in our culture is very anti those things, and they're discounted.
Right.
People who believe in them are considered to be either stupid or crazy.
Right. Yeah, they've been really suspect, those non-rational experiences of one's life have been suspect in our society. So we haven't valued, we call them irrational instead of non-rational.
But it seems to be in the spirit world, both forces of good and evil.
Okay. Right. Like the material world. Both possibilities exist. Okay, well, Borg says that, we have lost touch with that dimension, but that Jesus was very much in touch with that dimension, and that he says, this notion of another world understood as actual, even though non-material, is quite alien to modern way of thinking. The modern worldview or picture of reality sees reality as having essentially one dimension, the visible and material realm. Deeply ingrained in all of us who have grown up in modern Western culture, this worldview makes us skeptical about another reality. And so it requires faith on our part, rather than just being a normal part of our understanding of reality. The world of spirit is not part of our taking for granted understanding of reality, not part of our worldview. And he goes on to talk about how Jesus was deeply connected to this world of spirit. I'm trying to see if I could quickly put a finger on a quote for you. For Jesus, then, Borg claims that his baptism was critical to the beginning of his ministry, because that was, for him, Borg says, a descent into the Spirit at a whole new level, and that out of that came a whole new understanding of who he was and what his mission was going to be, and what his message was going to be, and so forth. That it was for him really a vision quest kind of experience. And then he continued then to engage in a variety of activities, encourage other people to engage in a variety of activities that would get them in touch more deeply with the spiritual dimension, particularly Jesus' prayer life and so forth. But out of his vision quest experience, which continued on through his own prayer life and so forth, came an understanding, Borg says, of who he was. He thinks the statement in Luke is critical to Jesus' understanding of himself. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, and to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. That is a Luke, isn't it?
Some
of your biblical scholars. Check my sources here. And that encapsulates for what Boric says for Jesus, his understanding of himself that comes out of this vision quest experience or this descent into the spirit. And I think it's a kind of interesting way of talking about Jesus. Okay, now I'd like to go on not to the culture part. And I think this is really one of the most, this was a learning experience for me. And this may be old hat to some of the rest of you, but it was new to me to listen to Boric talk about the culture of Jesus' day and how Jesus fit into that or didn't fit into that. And so he says that the thing that defined the culture of Jesus' day was what Boric calls the politics of holiness. And this is interesting. To be a holy person, you had to, as a part of the Jewish community, you had to fulfill not only your ritual obligations, but you also had to fulfill, of course, your financial obligations, Boric asserts in the book, which means that you had to pay what was due to, you know, the temple and to the authorities of your culture in the form of taxes and other things, as well as perform the necessary ritual functions. Now, because it was an occupied land, the Romans occupied the land and governed, and they also exacted taxes from people as a person in that culture. You were required to pay taxes, for example, not only to the Romans, but also to the Jewish state. Now, if you didn't pay taxes to the Romans, you were in deep trouble, as I understand it. If you didn't pay taxes to the Jewish state, you were also in trouble, but not as much trouble, because I don't think you didn't end up in jail. You were just considered an unclean person or an outcast person.
You couldn't worship at the temple.
What?
You couldn't then worship at the temple, basically.
Right.
Or associated with Jesus, I suppose.
Right.
You were able to trade with you.
And so there existed, as you can see very quickly, there existed in Jesus' day a significant portion of the population that was considered to be outcast. Not only did that include lepers and prostitutes and, you know, people like that, but it included all of these folks who couldn't afford to pay their Jewish taxes as well. And so Jesus had a rather substantial audience, you see. So along comes Jesus and says, you know, that there are some other ways to think about being holy here, other than fulfilling all of the of your obligations in terms of ritual obligations, in terms of taxation and so forth. And so Boric suggests that he his politics, which he describes as a politics of compassion, you know, was a breath of fresh air to rather sizable segment of the population. And so one of the things that Jesus did was found, essentially, Boric says, a new movement. So he calls him a movement, you know, foundation movement. What did he call it earlier? Beginner or something. And it was based largely, instead of on a politics of holiness, it was based on a politics of compassion. And compassion for those who had been rejected by the culture and by the society because they couldn't fit in either in terms of their lifestyles or in terms of their ability to perform the necessary rituals and financial obligations. Now he therefore proposes to us the question, you know, what would it mean then if Jesus was a kind of critic of his own culture and the politics of holiness? What would it mean for us to take Jesus seriously today and be critics of our own culture? What might be some examples of that? If Jesus were walking in our midst today, how would he be a critic, do you think, of our own culture?
We want to know where to start.
You can glorify a commercial critic.
All right. Okay.
He might not think much of
his capitalism. Okay. Be quiet. Can you say something
like that? No.
It's based on competition. And it seems like that were his followers in that time because they, you know, couldn't pay or... Uh-huh. It seems like a capitalist society might create a class like that, whereas other sorts of political systems might not, or at least they're not supposed to. And so he might not go for capitalism.
I kind of disagree with that. I see Jesus as you know, giving the talent and right. Not just to sit and hide, you're supposed to make,
okay.
You know, make money. You're supposed to work for a living. Just you know, throwing out of the...
Right.
I
think of the riots that happened in L.A. and across the cities in the country, and that I'm quite sure it was to be critical of the racism, and also I think the economics, the fact that we've created an underclass.
Okay.
And the violence and poverty in the city.
Okay.
I think you'd be horrified at big corporations paying their top executives $1 million a year at the same time that they're laying off the lowest paid workers who have the least ability to survive without a job, mm-hmm. and just leaving them out in the cold. And a nation that's been so blessed and has so much has lost the ability to share.
All right. The military, spending as much as we've been on security with the clothing buying.
Talk about a rich life in some other kinds of images would be, you know, seems to me would be the kind of thing that he would be talking about to us. It's interesting, I recently read in the newspaper in Seattle that someone gave a seminar on a rich life without money or something like that, you know, and expected 25 people to show up, and there was something like 400. I can't remember exactly the title of it, but it was intriguing. That, you know, there really are beginning to be some other images other than what we see on the billboards and in the advertisements and the commercials about, you know, what politics of compassion might look like in our society. Yeah.
And the New Roadmap people were doing it.
Yeah, I think it was. Thank you, Robin, and the New Roadmap Foundation.
Yeah, that's
they're giving
it.
Lots of seminars.
Yeah,
I read that too, that she said 5 years ago, like, five or ten people came, and this time they couldn't believe it. There's so much. People are feeling like all the stuff that they bought hasn't given them satisfaction. It must be a better way to live.
Yeah.
I want you to pay for the seminar.
Yeah.
I think it's free.
Yeah. Great.
I'd like to raise a question. I think it's a good, safe place to ask it.
Yeah, good.
Implicit in when we start naming off all these things, wondering about what Jesus, if he were here today, what he'd be upset with.
Right.
We pick out all these things, and we could, any one of these could be, these were created, or we've gotten in the messes of some of these, man has gotten us into that.
Right.
The inverse of that, we're saying the inverse of that would likely be better, but man will also have to do a lot of that, unless the Spirit gives it an overriding success. You see what I don't know if I'm saying that. In other words, the solution to solve any one of these things we talked about to make it better also has to come from the very people that maybe have caused it in the first place. You see what I mean? In other words, are there evil people that have done this? General Motors, are they that bunch of evil people? And then all of a sudden a bunch of good people will be in there, and then we've got it solved? We're all human.
Right. Yeah, I don't think Jesus would fall into that kind of dualistic thinking, but I think, you know, we all contain both of those possibilities.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
And what goes on collectively and so forth. Well, how do we get that lead? That's a good lead into then another point that the board wants to make. And so there's Jesus and his life in the Spirit, and set in the context of this culture where he's trying to advocate a politics of compassion. Now, what is it that he's teaching people? That's where this image of sage comes in. Jesus as sage and challenge to conventional wisdom and so forth. Let me read you just one little paragraph here. Some have thought that he was primarily a teacher of beliefs, or more precisely, of what was to be believed in order to be saved, providing correct information in the form of divine revelation about God and Jesus' own role in salvation. Others have stressed that he was a teacher of a new moral ethic, whether understood as a new moral code consisting of highly specific commands, or as a set of more generalized ideals such as love and justice or the golden rule or the brotherhood of humankind. But Jesus was not primarily a teacher of either correct beliefs or right morals. Rather, he was a teacher of a way or a path, specifically a way of transformation. His teaching involved a radical criticism of the conventional wisdom that lay at the core of the first century Jewish world. And so that's another image of Jesus that Bork presents. And let's push that around for a minute. You know, the early Christians called themselves the people of the way. That was actually a term that they used for themselves, so I'm led to believe. Now, most of us, I think, I grew up in a context where what it meant to be Christian was to hold certain beliefs. To be true, and in fact, when I even went to seminary, we spent long hours arguing about which beliefs were true and which beliefs were not true. I grew up, when I was going to seminary, I lived in an apartment complex, and there was a young man studying for the ministry. He went to a seminary owned and operated by the General Association of Reformed Baptists. I can always remember that because it's spelled GARP, you know. And he he was a delightful guy, very bright, very bright. But obviously, you know, came out of very fundamentalist roots. And so we would spend long hours arguing about, you know, whether I should be a premillennialist or a postmillennialist, you know, about dispensational theology. These were all categories as a Lutheran. I didn't even know what they meant. I mean, you know. But he was well versed in them and knew all the scripture references. And so he had me scurry. Now, I was just a good Lutheran. I mean, I didn't know any of this stuff.
Well, pre-post or mid-tribulation.
Right.
Also important, you know.
Foot washing. Some of you obviously have come up with some of these traditions, so you know these well. But I mean, we've spent a lot of energy as Christians, I guess, debating how many pins you can get on the head of an angel. No. Anyway. And there was always a real sense of you know, whether you were going to be kosher enough, and some of you probably been sure those examined. When I was examined in seminary, they brought me into this huge room, and it was a very stately room with dark beams, you know, and there was this big long table. There were all these clergy in their collars sitting there, and they would say, "Now, Mr. Hosser, tell us about Holy Communion." And of course, you had to have a pretty clear understanding of what their understanding of Holy Communion is to get through that. Anyway, but Borg says that, you know, that's not what Jesus was up to. What he advocated was a way. What does this word way or path conjure up in you? When you have an image of a way or a path. You
know? Well, the first thing I thought was this religious class I took in, you know, the survey of different religions. And when you said the way, I thought Taoism, Chinese religion, just about the way. I don't really understand that well, but it has to do with sort of following the path of these three systems, like water flows down, finding that path
that flows around and down.
Anyway, that, when you said the way, that's what I immediately
thought of
as other traditions.
That
does sound Eastern.
All right. Probably seven beliefs, I suppose, is the way. That's what we've been taught, I think. Rather than a lifestyle, which is part of what it should be.
I was thinking just off that the way makes me think of in your action and not your beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a process and not just a one-time dramatic conversion.
I would guess that Morgan and Jesus seminar people would think of halakha. The Hebrew word that the Pharisees and others were using for a way to be obedient to Torah that was so passable and consistent.
Okay.
So that when Jesus says things like, "I am the way," he means, "I have a halakha that allows you to live it." So,
okay.
What does that mean? The word is halakha.
The way.
Well, the same thing like it is.
How did Jesus teach you about the way?
When I think of the way, I think of a journey.
All right.
There's a story of blind Bartimaeus and following on the way. And in John, Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And there's also the story, the Haggadah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think it's more encompassing than when you define something as correct or incorrect.
Uh-huh.
I like it because it gives me more of an opportunity to be a co-creator with.
Okay.
With God.
All right.
I kind of think of it when I think about different people with different beliefs and different lifestyles. The way is one way that can be followed in life, or a way to live. said that can be distinguished from the other waves that are out there.
Okay. Okay, Borg asserts that if the way Jesus taught about the way he was describing is contained largely in his parables, proverbs that he used, lessons from nature, and so forth, and that he used those teaching, that kind of pedagogy, that teaching style, to talk about a way of being, a way of living within God's reign, his kingdom, and so forth. And there's a whole chapter on that, which I find really Jesus is sage. Really quite interesting. We won't go through it all here, but I would encourage you to read it. But he also felt that the whole notion of grace was central to Jesus' life, so that his way is not a kind of way dependent upon fulfilling requirements. That was not the part of his politics of compassion involved for Jesus a kind of unconditional expression of God's love for humankind. So that's you might say a kind of overlay always on this way. But any time a way slops into requirements, then it's not the way that Jesus is talking about. And so there's interesting tension there in Borg's assertion about what Jesus was up to. Okay, we're going to lose our time here before very long. He also wants to say that Jesus is, of course, also a prophet, that he founded a peace party, and in that sense, he really was, in many ways, sort of counter-culture to his time. That he constantly ate with outcasts. And then Borg, challenges us to think about that, those as images for our faith community today, and whether or not, we are following that kind of way as a church. Then he talks about, of course, Jesus as this founder of this movement, and feels that ultimately that's probably what led to his death. And that's the last part of the book, which I find kind of interesting. And there was some new stuff in that for me too that I hadn't thought about before. He feels that the Romans were perfectly capable of executing Jesus, and may well have really been the ones behind it, because they couldn't tolerate or didn't wish to tolerate any kind of movements that in any way threatened the stability of the Roman Empire. He says, for example, from what we know about Roman policy in Palestine, and Pilate's character in particular, it's completely conceivable the Romans alone were responsible for the entire scenario of arrest, trial, and execution. Rome was chronically suspicious of indigenous movements within her occupied territories, and Palestine had a reputation for being more troublesome than most. Pilate himself was reputed to be ruthless. Appointed by an anti-Semite, his 10 years in office were particularly harsh. The portrait of him vacillating during the trial and finally giving in to the Jewish authorities is out of character. Though it may reflect actual history, it may equally be the product of the early church's tendency to shift the blame away from Rome. Its effect is to say Rome found nothing wrong with this person, but it is easy to imagine that Pilate would have taken action against a Jewish charismatic leader who had attracted a considerable following and became a major center of attention in Jerusalem at the volatile season of Passover. And I haven't heard that articulated. Maybe that's old stuff to some of us. But I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, who knows if it's true or not, but it's an interesting kind of assertion. Borg feels that Jesus, you know, his death came not so much that he was fulfilling a role that he had known about since day one, but was the culmination of his work as a sage, a prophet, and a foundation movement founder, that it just ultimately came to this, and that he decided to, stick with his convictions about these things, and that ultimately meant death for him. And so that's an interesting argument in the book as well. Well, we have about 5 minutes left. We can talk about anything.
Yeah. You have a question. That is, in something you said, well, 3-4 minutes ago, you said that what the charge, not the charge, but what it meant to the church. And that kind of struck me, what it means to the individual, which leads to the question, are in the way, as we visualize it, and as it was visualized, the way is not, well, both an individual thing, and it's also collective, members of the way all together that do some of these things. It's not just an individual going on to the wilderness and worshiping. Would that be the way? See what I mean? If these things that we mentioned before are things can be done individually, you may not be able to get much done.
Right.
So the way would mean banding together as a church or whatever, get it done.
Yeah, I think he had a real sense of community, a sense of which self is a social entity. I don't think he was so much into the whole individualistic stuff, which, of course, Christianity has fallen into today.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's also a product of our society. I mean, our society has become very individualistic in what we've done. In Christianity, it just take over that value and apply it. And so what it means to be Christian is that, it's a very personal matter. It's a personal relationship between me and God exclusively. I'm not saying that dimension doesn't need to be there, but I think it really does. Or one's, I think one needs one's own religious experience.
You think that's just a modern phenomenon? Do you think that more back to the medieval monastic tradition about the monks and their cells praying to God but not really mixing out with the community at all?
Yeah, but that was also very much subverted your own individuality to the collective. It's a very collective. In fact, that's part of the problem with monasticism, was that the individual got so lost in it. You weren't allowed to be your own person, in a sense. You had to very much live under the discipline of whatever discipline you entered into. So, I think that's why they ultimately sort of died out. But we've kind of gone the other direction today, that they were going society, if everybody could have their way, they'd all win the lottery, build a little wall around themselves, and live totally independent, with no obligations or accountability to anybody else. Do whatever you please, whenever you want to do it. I mean, isn't that the great American dream? Buy whatever you want, whenever you want to buy it. And so it becomes very individualistic society. But, you know, that's, get me off on that tangent.
Mm-hmm. But you can't be a good member of the way until you yourself have searched it out, your own personal journey, and then, right?
Right.
Then you can become a, well, yeah, in many different ways, but to be a real, for the way to get something done, so to speak, to take care of these, you really have to be comprised of individuals that are all committed to that cause.
Right.
Okay, you can't give up your individual reasoning or connection, right, because then you could fall into something like, not seeing what those wars were called when everyone was the truth day. You know, where you don't think about the reasons, you just do things. That's what you're planning to do. So
right,
that's the balance between right, the two things.
That's the point. The thing that excited me about Borg was that I think he portrays a Jesus that's very much alive and in the midst of all the struggles of a particular time. We want us to be the same. It's just not a belief system, you know. You believe it or you don't, and that's what it means to be Christian or something. It is a way of life, a journey. It's Jesus is very much a part of being a critic of his time, and yet he lived very much in the time. So he portrays, you know, I think a very exciting portrait.
Does he address the divine human question at all? Or does he just kind of not touch that issue?
You'd have fairly, you'd have to say he skirts it, you know. Mm-hmm. Come back later in the summer and ask him.
What time is he coming this summer?
End of July.
End of July.
But what he does do is he talks about, and I think he wants to make a case for the fact that this, you know, that Jesus drew his strength from his connection to the spirit and the spiritual dimension of life, and that dimension is available to us. What he doesn't address is the question of, you know, does Jesus have connections that you and I don't have? Right?
that's what I was trying to say earlier. That question.
He told us that if we have the faith of a mustard seed, yeah, you know, it kind of implies that we all are capable of that.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah. The other thing, those books where like Joshua and the children,
yeah,
I know how many people have read those, but that book kind of reminds me in a sort of a novel sort of form what this guy's trying to describe in an intellectual playing here at what Jesus would be in this world and setting, and he just kind of found himself dropped down here on the screen.
It's insights into his humanity and kind of the divinity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what he's trying to say is that what he's talking about here are connections that Jesus had that he's proposing we can also have as well. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't get much beyond that. So I'm going to ask him that question. But it is a very refreshing look at Jesus, and I think it gets us out of the kind of sweet Jesus that if you believe in strong enough, all is going to be well. You know? And not that Jesus isn't sweet, and not that Jesus isn't our friend, and isn't a companion, and so forth, but, you know, we need to get beyond that image to some other more rooted, grounded kind of images. Well, I hope I've accomplished my goal in intriguing you. Thanks.